welcome to the Double Disillusionist. Just me, Dom Knight, with Andrew P. Street this week.
There's nothing just you about this. It's just us.
Back to the old school for our
totes
1 year anniversary edition. Happy anniversary, Andrew.
Thank you. It's been a beautiful year-o-pod.
It has. We're talking to microphones with people about politics and occasionally on stages. It's been very enjoyable. And what better thing to discuss this week than our victory? Andrew, our stunning victory. Before we get onto that, though, just a plug. The next live show is at Giant Dwarf on Tuesday, the 6th of June. We have one confirmed guest, Mr. Osman Faruqi of Junkie, who is brilliant and will
be terrific.
You can go and book at, by the time this is up, giantdwarf.com.au. Jump on there, come along. There's beer. We do stupid stuff as well as talk about serious politics. We run weird polls and... read poetry written by politicians and other stuff like that. It's always
it's a real multimedia experience.
It is. We try to do a little bit extra. And here's the thing. The podcast, political chat every week. But the live show, we don't record the second half. You've got to be in the room. Once people have had a glass or two of the fine Australian produce, opinions become looser, don't they?
They do. And people are prepared to say tell you kind of the off-the-record stories that they tell people late at night at sort of the dinner parties that none of us get invited to.
No, but instead you are invited to politics in the pub, in a sense, with jokes at Giant Dwarf. Enough plug. Now, what we are right about, the great victory that we have is that, as we've mentioned a few times, Andrew and I on the same day, no less for different media organisations, demanded that Malcolm Turnbull moved to the centre. We couldn't understand why he wasn't doing it.
We did.
It made such sense.
We said it.
That after years of doing far-right, make-only-the-IPA-happy politics, they should try doing stuff people actually like in the popular centre.
It's a zany idea, you know. But, look, we believed, as clearly somebody in the Liberal Party hive mind did ahead of this budget, that this would be a winning strategy, that this would bring him back, make Turnbull the leader that we all thought he was going to be, the anti-Abbott, the man who Annabelle Crabb beautifully described Abbott actually as the opposition leader who had negotiated a work from government deal, which I thought was extremely good. But yes, the leader that we thought we were getting in the heady days of October 2015.
So, not all the way. We haven't completely succeeded in our pitch, which was, hey, Malcolm, why don't you start this new rebranding of yourself with the obvious thing that everyone wants you to do, same-sex marriage. Well, when I say everyone, I mean nearly everyone, and et cetera, it's going to happen anyway. Let's not go down that alley.
We've been down there before.
But what we do have is a budget that took many by surprise, and that reflects a new reality in Australian politics, which I think Mark Kenny wrote about, that you can't dump the PM. It's a stupid idea, just as it always was.
I thought you were going to say the new reality, which is we can't get a surplus.
We can't. That's true. Surpluses, no one gives a stuff about. What people care about is their hip pocket.
Good debt now.
And they care about the stuff they care about, which is often health, education, generally the non-terrifying future stuff.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that this budget reflected the recognition of the desire on the part of the Australian electorate not to die in a ditch. That was pretty much the... I mean, I say that. Obviously, if you're unemployed, then dying in a ditch is still very much open to you, although only if you're not taking drugs.
So let's have a bit of a look at what they did now that the dust has settled somewhat, the Liberal budget, as it's been called. What did they do that was so surprisingly centrist? And then the things where the government actually pretty much kept business as usual. And then Labor's response, which was quite a strange balancing act between saying, no, they're not us, and, we support that stuff. But they're not us. And why they were not trying to be us, but they are trying to be us. But they're not trying to be us, but they are us, but they're not us. I'm Bill Shorten.
I actually thought it was a surprisingly successful speech from Shorten, not least because it was so refreshing to see one of the major parties define what it was that they stood for in fairly straightforward policy terms rather than vague kind of value statements. And particularly since I think it's extremely difficult to look at the budget from the government and get a really clear idea what it is that they're standing for now, because it's not fiscal discipline, which has been a long sort of shibboleth of the party. It's certainly not continuing to offer that all-important choice to parents in whether they want to send their children to a private school or force them to endure a badly underfunded public school. That's now out the window with the almost adoption of the Gonski reforms.
Wasn't that an amazing thing to see David Gonski turn up? And
it was Al Gore with Clive Palmer all over again.
Yes, it was. Quite surprising. Except that, I mean, this is a lot of what happened. The government simply seized the ground that Labor intended to fight it on. It was, in a sense, the government's attempt to inoculate itself against the attack lines that were going to work. And so when they're raving on about Gonski and going the full Gonski, and there's David Gonski, what a clever little ploy that was from Malcolm Turnbull. There was quite a bit of uncharacteristic cleverness in this particular strategy, I feel.
There was. And it was kind of... I mean, this is one of the things about Turnbull which you'd be forgiven for forgetting in the last little while, which is that every so often he just pulls out one of these nice little sidesteps, as he did when he prorogued Parliament to return. That was a pretty neat trick.
Apparently, you do get the barristerial brilliance here and then where he does trick that. It's been suppressed so ruthlessly. But look, they may as well let Turnbull be Turnbull to a certain degree, because the alternatives, as we discussed before, are Duttonian. So why not
give this a go? But, I mean, then again, the for all of the praise that the budget got for how nimble and agile and, one might say, innovative the Prime Minister was, it was such an ideas
boom. It's a bit of an ideas boom. We've mocked him for that, but there's a little bit of booming.
Of the ideas are kind of mad, like a inland rail line from Brisbane to Melbourne that doesn't sort of go via Sydney. That seems
inland. The great is you can go over the vast inland sea.
Perfect. But the it did leave an awful lot of room for Labor, which mainly in things like completely ignoring any kind of environmental moves. Beyond that, there's going to be greater subsidies for natural gas, which is not, one needs to point out, super environmental.
Well, it's better than coal.
And it's better than coal, but it's not good. I mean, you know, it is coal seam gas. We are creating emissions with this.
Oh yeah, no, look, in one sense, he's tried to do the Turnbull switcheroo, which we've talked about before, where he gives the base a little bit of red meat and thinks that they're not going to look too closely. And the clear advantage of that, I thought, was the announcement that they were going to drug test welfare cheats, drug test them. You're not getting any bucks out of the government if you don't, pee correctly.
If you're going there, taking all your marijuanas and your ecstasies and partying all day, no more. No more we support you. But it's out of love. It's out of love.
Tough love. All this tough love. When's anyone ever defrauded a drug test other than at every Olympics anyway? So that was that sort of stuff. But
Nation
then
of cyclists.
Just this little bit of stuff for the Abbott factor, just to be like, there are a few things Abbott just could not help but praise, really. Because he wished he'd done them and pretended that he would have again.
I'm amazed he didn't pretend that he had.
Yeah, that's entirely in the realm of possibility. Didn't he invent the phrase priming the pump? But then
I've got to say, when Trump claimed that he had invented the phrase priming the pump, I have not. I mean, most of my laughter at things Trump has done has been kind of like the terrified laughter of the damned. That was one of the few moments of genuine joy where it's like, you know, you just have this hopeful moment of, oh, thank God, he is just taking the piss. And then you go, no, actually, maybe he's genuinely that delusional. This is more terrifying. And then I hid in a bush like I was Sean Spicer.
Among the bushes, Andrew. Among the bushes. Not in the bushes. Okay, so essentially the budget, it did fund a lot of stuff that traditionally the coalition has, in the attempt to vaguely make the budget balance not wanted to do. In particular, schools we looked at, mm-hmm. They're slinging money towards health in various ways. They're ending the Medicare freeze, which is certainly
gradually,
something.
Gradually, in a way that is ironically glacial.
It's not Howard style hand over fist middle class welfare, but certainly they're greasing the wheels far more than they would have before.
And they're being very, I mean, while the tax cut for big business is still on the table, they've kind of made a symbolic attack on the banks, secure in the knowledge that literally nobody in the country is going to leap to support a bank under any circumstance.
$6.2 billion, I think, out of the banks, although bearing in mind that they're also getting the company tax cut.
So. Yeah.
When we talk about the budget too, we should remember that, of course, given the situation in the Senate, probably none of it will even get through.
There is that.
And the only thing that will get through is just all the stuff that's generous, and so we'll have even more of a deficit. But so the government certainly tried. They tried to reposition themselves for an election. Remember that popularity is actually currency in politics. And they were hoping, I'm sure, for a boost in the polls, for a Malcolm's back. Let's start getting that news poll positive to the point where Tony Abbott can't say, oh, that's 30, buddy. Mm. See ya. That's the magic number.
And that's kind of what was interesting about today, because we got the Fairfax Ipsos poll and we got News poll, who came with the exact same numbers. One went down, the other went up. And so we're still at a 47-53 lead to Labour. As far as Fairfax are concerned, this is a slight improvement in the government's situation. As far as News poll are concerned, it's a deterioration of the government's position. I mean, realistically, it's all within the sort of margin of error. So it probably doesn't actually mean anything at all, which is
53-47
isn't even
though
more worrying.
I mean, the shifts were the shift of 1 point certainly is within the margin of error, but. The 53-47 split is total curtains for the government. It would be absolute bedlam for them if this doesn't improve.
Yeah, but my point is that it hasn't really fundamentally changed from what it was before the budget. And so it's interesting to see the way that the different news outlets have chosen to interpret it. It's become this kind of political Rorschach test where, for The Australian, for example, this is proof. People have rejected the budget. This tricky move to the left has been revealed for the political theatre that it is.
Because moving to the far right works so well.
Look
at Corey Bernardi. I mean, he's effectively prime minister in waiting from the Senate.
And then Fairfax, on the other hand, was saying, this is very positive. This is proof that, you know, that their poll numbers are on the increase and Malcolm Turnbull is more popular. But the most interesting thing in the numbers, though, was that the primary vote for both has gone up a little bit at the expense of all the minors. Like the Greens have dropped slightly, One Nation have dropped slightly.
They're both about 8 or 9%, I think,
I think the Greens were third. I think that might be on like 12.
We're looking at different polls. So look, no conclusive signs that it's actually worked. It's going to take more than a few budget tricks to turn the fortunes around for Malcolm Turnbull. He's certainly giving it a red-hot go. And he's given Bill Shorten a bit of a challenge. Bill Shorten, who looked as though he were going to waltz over the line with the government's determination never to change anything that the National Party, for instance, were unhappy with, to try and please all of the backbenchers all of the time. That wasn't going to work, and they've now tried something else. So Shorten had a bit of a challenge here. He had to try and oppose many things he disagreed with in some respects and thread the needle there. And also brand differentiation was a challenge here. I mean, Labor kind of invented the whole let's just go to the centre with some economic hard-headedness. That was the Hawke Keating trick. And so for Turnbull to go into that territory, there's a bit of a brand issue there that's a challenge to Shorten, who has, as we've said before, moved the party to the left over the past few years.
He has, and I think it was remarkably well handled because he left, I think, a lot of problems for Turnbull to sort out. I mean, one of the big ones was saying, okay, we'll wave through the tax on banks, which leaves the banks being very much Turnbull's problem, because there is going to be, I mean, it's already begun, there is going to be a large-scale campaign
from the banks. Backlash, if you will.
Oh, nice. You should do radio.
But I do radio where I don't get to talk about this stuff very much, so it's a pleasure to be here. No, but look, this is the mining tax in reverse, and the mining tax did work very well. I suspect banks might be an even harder sell, but with Anna Bligh on board, giving her gift for winning over the people.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, it's always good when you see somebody really kind of get solidly into bed with big business. I mean, we've seen that with Stephen Conroy and the gambling lobby as well. It's just
so many of them.
It makes you feel good about the people that you've elected to Parliament and definitely maintains, I think, something which a lot of people in New South Wales felt with the career of Mike Baird, of just like, so really being Premier was kind of a stepping stone to a sweet job with the banks.
It was an audition, really.
Yes, yeah, and it's also
kind of his gap years there, where, you know, in between bank job and bank job with the NAB, he went off to just dabble in politics a little bit, just soften things up, just to keep the banks hungry.
The horrifying thing is that does strike me as Mike Baird's idea of a backpacking holiday around South America. He's just like, I'll just be Premier of New South Wales for a bit, see how that shakes out.
Yeah, just till it gets hard. Yeah. Just till it gets easy, slightly hard, and I try and take principles, stances, and can't convince everyone. Then I'm out. See ya. Anyway, so now Shorten did have quite a challenge. And can we talk, though, because, look, it was if you go and read the speech, there are a lot of good things about it. But his delivery... Oh, my gosh, I'm Bill Shorten. I have a problem with this. I come from the pantomime school of acting. Wow, that was bad.
There is... I think we've talked about this before. Somewhere in the heart of the Labour Party machine, there is a media advisor who is on far too much lithium. Because they are advising everybody. The first thing that you should do when you're in power is to halve the speech, the rate at which you speak.
Like a kindergarten teacher.
You've got people like... I mean, Julia Gillard, who's great off the cuff, and as soon as she became leader, she sounded Australia's hectoring auntie.
I mean,
Rand, the Premier of South Australia, again... Perfectly normal human being when he's speaking until he was addressing the people of South Australia, where it was like, you know, television has sound. Like we don't have to lip read. You don't have to enunciate every word. Although we probably should. Are we slurring this whole podcast?
But Malcolm Turnbull does give a demeanour of head prefect at an oratory competition, which he was. He literally was that at my old school. You know, but the funny thing about it is authentic. Like, that's who he is. He does that, and it's literally just the guy. He'd talk to you like that if you met him for a beer, I imagine. Whereas Shorten, we know what he sounds like when he's being himself. If we can cast our mind back to Beaconsfield, that was actually... an ordinary person talking about things that mattered to him, or certainly appeared to be. Where's that guy?
Well, like, remember how much Australia sat up when Shorten was doing a doorstop in Parliament House, and through that, at least I'm not a homophobe, mate, at Corey Bernardi. Everybody just went, I like this fellow. He's sharp with a bitchy quip.
Someone said to me this week that the best thing Shorten could do and just be remembered as a legend forever in Australian politics, you stand aside for Albo and be number two. Like, just for once go, I'm your treasurer. I'm going to be a great manager of the economy. And Albo can do the hearts and minds stuff. And he's the guy Australia wants to have a beer with. And perhaps get him to spin some sweet tunes on the decks. you know, just give us your Smiths, Albo. Come on. And I'll do the management stuff. Because he's not authentic. He's just never been authentic, Shorten, in that job. He never will be. It was a perfectly good speech, and he did thread the needle reasonably well. And the best part of the speech for mine was where, as you said before, he did say, this is what Labor believes in, this is what Labor believes in. It isn't actually what Labor believes in whenever they're in power. But in opposition, it sounds good. It was a heartland speech. It was for the true believers. and it fought hard for the middle. And it presented the government's budget as a trick, basically, as an attempt to wolf in sheep's clothing, in a sense.
And, I mean, there are a couple of moments that clanged like a kettle falling down a stairwell, like where he was trying to argue for an egalitarian approach to schools funding that also favoured the Catholic's education system because, you know, the Catholic education system are busily doing a, you know,
that really
making an attack against the government that Labour would very much like them to continue doing.
The enemy of my enemy is still not my friend.
No, that's the thing that they've got to understand. It is so many other parts of the speech. Shorten, I think, did the absolute right thing, which was he said, this is a good idea and we'll support it. It doesn't go far enough and we think it should go further, but, you know, we will support the Gonski funding, although we think it should have the final 2 years put in. We will support a levy on to fund the NDIS, but it should only be on the top earners. And that's the stuff where it's going to be very far from kind of the government creating a problem for Labour. I think Labour really lobbed a lot of those back over the net and turned things into real problems for the government, because now the government has to argue, why is it better for everybody, including people at the bottom, to be funding something that can be funded by the people at the top who are getting a tax break?
Well, this is one of the huge issues that's going to bedevil them somewhat until polling day is the company tax cut, which I think $63 billion. At last.
Well,
count.
Now that they keep accidentally. Well, I mean, they didn't. It wasn't really check. A mistake. It was just that the time period changed.
They can check ScoMo's calculator again for a new figure in 12 months. But the bottom line is, if you're cutting $63 billion out of the budget, that allows Labor to have an awful lot of cake and eat it while achieve the same budget outcome. So if there's bipartisan agreement that the deficit's, whatever. Unless you believe, as Donald Trump does, and there's the first alarm, that tax cuts just magically trickle down into economic growth. Unless you believe that, old furphy, then you realise that Labor has all this money just to slosh around. They can fully fund things left, right and centre without having to make these sorts of compromises. And Shorten could have done more to claim the whole thing as a victory. But the line surely is why go for the imitator? Why when there's where the real deal, where we've always believed in this stuff. He did sort of say things along those lines, but that's the thing. He's already won the battle for what matters. That's always the, you know, for many years the Liberals have banged on about fiscal discipline and so on, and that line doesn't fly anymore.
Yeah. Well,
thank God. Debt, whatever. Let, you know.
And this is kind of the reverse of the problem that Labor used to have, that as it moved sort of further and further right towards the centre, particularly during the Howard years, it was very hard to make a case as to why people would vote Labour when they could have the Liberal Party who were already there.
Yeah, yeah. Have all your security and discipline, whatever, and here's a sweet, sweet handout for you because we've got a mining boom happening.
Exactly. And so now the problem the government's going to have is if it's going to do all of this stuff that is heartland Labour, but not as much as the... And the thing that its trade-off is... We're going to give this tax break to the top half of town and we're going to drug test the unemployed. It's kind of hard to see why that's a winning strategy. And yeah, and I realised that particularly the drug testing thing, I cannot see it getting through the Senate. I mean, certainly I the Greens and Labour would be mad to support it. I can't see... Well, the Greens certainly won't. I can't see Labour letting this one through. It's too obvious a class war issue.
And look, the junkie vote is there for the taking.
Well, this is it. I mean, you know, if there's one thing that we have learned, it's that they're a really important important constituency in the Australian landscape.
It is the one thing that will make long-term heroin users turn up to vote, I imagine, on election day. Yeah, it is a weird situation. And the old, as someone said, the... It might have been Peter Credlin said, actually, that the Howard Costello government is finally over. That entire way of doing business is finished. And for a while we've been saying, well, what can they do if not Turnbull? There's not an attractive alternative. I think this budget essentially admitted that, which is sensible. But where they're at, it seems, is, okay, we've conceded a bunch of this sort of stuff. will potentially avert disaster, but there's still not a reason to vote for this government over the Labor alternative. There's, they may be able to tease one out in an election campaign, and goodness knows there are always plenty of reasons not to vote Labor. But in the interim, yeah, if because the there's always a battle over what matters as well as what the policies actually are. And if you start saying education and health and that sort of stuff is what matters most, if people care more about that sort of stuff, if they're talking more about that, then yeah, that's when Labor wins. Labor wins when welfare and that sort of stuff is front of mind, and the coalition wins when economics and security are. Whether or not you think one or the other party does those areas better doesn't even matter. If we're worried about the economy and national security, we're going to vote for the coalition. We just always have.
And this is one of the reasons why actually there was an editorial today where it was suggested that we are now at the point where there will not be another, you know, leadership change because the government have realized that that way disaster lies.
Yeah.
I actually wonder if it's not slightly more likely now, because if this doesn't turn out to be a potent strategy to win hearts and minds, there's nowhere they can maneuver. Like, Turnbull cannot say, oh, actually, I've been having a think. Debt's a big problem.
No.
Now that I look at the numbers on Scott's calculator, boy, howdy, we need to go back to fiscal rectitude.
It is the last resort, isn't it? You're right. It is the probably the stuff he's been arguing to do since he got there. Surely he's been making this case since the beginning and being a good partisan player and keeping the hardcore stuff in there. But if this doesn't work out, it's the end of his prime ministership. But that's okay. At least he'll die on his own terms.
Yeah.
But what happens is that when we get closer to an election, the incumbent factor does kick in and people start thinking about keeping the current government. Now, if in the intervening 2 years they've started to look competent and caring and if they've started to deliver, if they've actually made things happen, then it will be an attractive pitch. I think it's the best thing that the government can do from here, given the abominable Abbott period and the fairly weird period early in the Turnbull period. Another thing that's been said, Andrew, which I think is a cause for national celebration, is that this budget, and full credit to the PM for it, it's a rejection of Trumpism. It's both rejecting and trying to neutralise Trumpism. It's giving stupid people who care about stupid things enough stupidity to keep them happy with the 457 rubbish and all that sort of stuff. But it's basically saying we don't go down that path, not here. It's not going to work. And frankly, thank fuck.
I could not agree more. Like, I think anything that moves us away, I mean, despite the fact that there is still that kind of trickle-down economics thing, which Trump seems to be 100% about.
You can't say trickle-down in connection with Trump without me thinking something completely different now. Yeah. That's just a thing.
I mean, I'm just really curious as to whether there is some trick that I am missing here on this looks like a pre-election budget.
Yeah.
And as best I can work out, the earliest that we could have an election would be around about November next year because there are Senate.
That's not a half Senate.
Yeah. So.
Sorry, that is a regular half Senate election.
Yeah. That's a regular half Senate election. And, you know, history suggests that that governments don't like going to late in the year elections. They would rather wait until probably, say, March, April, May. Try and getting away from the Christmas period. Because, I mean, aside from anything else, you don't want to be paying those extra penalty rates for your... Oh, that won't be a problem by that stage. Anyway, but the... So I'm wondering if there's some weird constitutional quirk a la recalling the Senate that we haven't stumbled across that means that if there is a bit of a spurt that there's a way of Turnbull calling an early poll, but I can't see one.
I think
double dissolution's not.
I mean, as against that, be fascinating to know whether Theresa May has any blowback from this. I think she won't, but certainly in Australia, making people vote without needing to, I think you get punished. I reckon no one who's compulsorily dragged to the shops for a snag is going to go, great to have the chance to give my opinion. I reckon they're going to go, we gave you 3 years, buddy. You're out. So I think it's rebranding. I think it's about last time round, Turnbull ran on nothing. He didn't want to run on their legacy. He didn't have any policy he was allowed to promote. So he basically just said, stick to the plan. Not going to say what the plan is. But there's a plan. Stick to the plan.
The plan is in this mysterious box.
Yes. You open it. It's got a golden hue, but we don't know what it is. It's a MacGuffin, people. And that was... He barely survived on that. Mm. This is about branding Turnbull as in favour of actually having a positive program. Mm. It's not quite 100 positive policies, because that's great, but I think it's the best he can do, given the situation that he's in politically, given the how he got the right of the party to stay back in their box for some of this stuff, I do not know. But as I guess the one thing we do know is that survival tends to trump principle for almost all. Except for perhaps Sweet Matthias.
Well, this is true. Although, if there is not a fairly significant improvement in the polls, I wonder how long the right of the party are going to stay in their little quiet corner.
Well, Corey Bernardi has been ropeable. Of course he has.
Well, he's been so sad that the media haven't been calling him. Poor Corey.
We should call him on stage show. Why don't we...
Yeah, give Colin a yell.
If you made it this far on the podcast,
yeah,
I reckon we should tweet us if you think we should. Particularly, I've got open DMs. If you got his mobile number, at Dom Knight, just saying. Yeah, so I don't see where else they can go. I don't rapidly, as our dear friend, the people's champion, Sean Kelly, pointed out. Mm. Turnbull's there not to be Abbott. Not being Abbott was popular. The reason he's dropped is because he's been more like Abbott than people wanted him to be. So they might as well try letting the guy who was very popular do the things that made him popular. Mm. It's not the dumbest idea in the world.
Look, I think it's very shrewd. I just wonder what the... it's a gamble that needs to pay off. But, I don't know, I guess all gambles do.
Then again, Andrew, if you're of the right and you're thinking of... potentially mounting a coup, you're not going to be there for long. I mean, if the Dutster does get in there, surely even he realises now in their reptilian brain, the notion is penetrated, that he won't be around. So it's the contest to become the next. At the moment, all that tension is about who gets to become the leader of the opposition, except for emeritus lifetime Tony Abbott. Oh, Annabelle Crabb.
She's a smart cookie, that Crabb woman, I tell you.
That she is. But he's Malcolm Turnbull. Smart. We'll find out in the weeks ahead. It just got very interesting again, didn't it?
Look, and I'm excited that we're talking about policy. Like, it's not just an endless sort of personality clash.
Leadership.
Some proper ideas. And some of those ideas are barking. But at least they're ideas. It's getting into a pretty interesting time. I'm excited about politics again.
I'm excited about peeing into a cup and seeing if I'm fit to receive handouts.
Look, I've been offering for a while now. And, I'm just delighted that finally the government are going to start accepting my urine instead of sending it back with a court order.
6th of June at Giant Dwarf. We've got to do something on urine tests.
Yeah. Shall we? I'm not good. I'm not okay with testing our audience's urine.
No, but...
I'm just putting that out there right now.
Let's just see what we can come up with. Okay, GiantDwarf.com.au, you can book there right now. We're back here next week with another installment of the free internet-only non-live podcast as well. I can't think of a suitable ending at this point.
It doesn't ever end, though, does it? We've been doing this for a year. This is open-ended.
It's an ongoing conversation.
It is. It is an ongoing conversation.
Let's leave the people hanging, Andrew.